This meeting of the House Environment Finance Division will come to order. Folks will have a series of presentations today from the University of Minnesota, and then at the end of session we will be considering House File 80, which has been heard, to move that to the Ways and Means Committee. I think we have a quorum here. Is there someone who would like to move the minutes? Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chair, I'd gladly move the minutes of the previous meeting.
Representative Sundin moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Congratulations on adopting the minutes. This afternoon we are going to have presentations from the University of Minnesota, and I'm going to ask that folks hold their questions because we have a number of presenters. And we're going to start with Dean Trevor Ames from the College of Veterinary Medicine and Dr. Mark Osterholm from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee.
Chair Hansen, committee members, I'm Trevor Ames, Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. It's my privilege to be here and visit with you. Thank you for this opportunity to provide additional information about chronic wasting disease since our last discussion with the Environmental Policy Committee. Some of you were present for that discussion, but some of you were not. We'll try to cover important points and then avoid unnecessary redundancy. As I mentioned at the last hearing, the university was contacted by a number of legislators over the last year requesting our involvement in a solution for the chronic wasting disease issue. Since our presentation a couple of weeks ago, we have met with members of the House and Senate and discussed this proposal in more detail, and many excellent questions have emerged. We have brought additional faculty expertise today to try and answer those questions. I'm joined by Professor Michael Osterholm from the School of Public Health, as well as Professors Sheffers and Larson from the College of Veterinary Medicine and Professor O from the College of Science and Engineering. As we discussed last time, chronic wasting disease, or CWD, represents a significant threat to our wild and farm cervidae populations. It is a progressive fatal disease that affects the brain, spinal cord, and many other tissues of farm and free-ranging deer, elk, and moose. And it causes neurologic dysfunction and significant weight loss, leading to death. CWD belongs to a family of diseases called prion diseases, or transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, TSEs. Other TSEs include mad cow disease, scrapie of sheep and goats, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, and variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or the human form of mad cow disease. The disease causing agent of CWD, the proteins or prions, are shed in saliva, feces, urine from infected animals and are contained in muscle and other organs. To date, as we discussed last time, there is no epidemiologic evidence of or reported cases for the occurrence of CWD in people, and it's not known if people can get infected with the CWD prions. But there is some experimental studies that have shown transmission of CWD prions to primates and human cell lines, which raises concern. Since 1997, the World Health Organization has recommended that it is important to keep the disease causing prions from entering the human food chain. As of August 1 of 2018, there are now 2,026 counties in 23 states with reported CWD in the free-ranging cervids. This information will obviously be updated when all the data from the fall surveillance programs are included. In the last 3 years, Minnesota DNR has identified 35 wild deer that were positive for CWD. Many counties in Wisconsin, in southern Wisconsin, are now endemic with large populations of deer being positive for CWD. And these infected counties in Wisconsin have all become positive since the early 2000s. In Minnesota, our DNR and Board of Animal Health work jointly to monitor and control CWD in farmed and wild cervidae. So the funding that we're requesting is to develop a more rapid and sensitive test that could be used to detect disease in living animals, hunter-harvested deer, farm deer that have died or are slaughtered, and environmental samples. We believe this type of test is needed to allow more timely testing of hunter-harvested deer, making consumption of chronic wasting disease positive deer less likely. Dr. Osterholm will discuss the potential public health risks of chronic wasting disease to humans in more detail, but I believe we should do everything possible to keep this agent out of the human food chain. The test we are proposing will also allow the DNR to deal with carcass disposal in a more timely fashion and also allow active monitoring of farm cervidae prior to death. It will also provide the ability to understand the environmental contamination and risks and enhance monitoring efforts of wild populations. I would like to ask Dr. Osterholm to make some remarks about the public health risks of chronic wasting disease. He will be followed by College of Veterinary Medicine faculty discussing the status of our current testing and the test we are proposing to develop. The College of Veterinary Medicine faculty will be also joined by the College of Science and Engineering faculty, who will discuss the engineering aspects of the test we are proposing. Dr. Osterholm.
Thank you.
Dr. Osterholm.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a great honor to be back before you again. And let me just say it's with some reflection that I'm here to share what I am today. 34 years ago this month, I sat in this very room in a very similar situation trying to offer a perspective on HIV, or at that time just AIDS, infection and what it might mean in terms of our future. And that was a sobering perspective. And unfortunately, while I don't believe that this is in a similar level of concern, I will offer a perspective today which is not rosy about the situation before us. To begin with, let me just remind everyone, as Professor Ames has indicated, that this is not a new situation for us. Chronic wasting disease was first identified in 1967 in captive mule deer in Colorado, the prion-caused disease that was already discussed. But however, there's been subsequent widespread transmission literally in the last 8 to 10 years that has changed the situation in terms of potential human exposure, with now transmission at least 24, potentially 26 states and 2 provinces in Canada. This changes the entire picture. Since chronic wasting disease has not yet been found to cause infections in humans, still a number of health agencies have taken the stance that people should not be consuming chronic wasting disease positive animal meat. Since 1997, the WHO or World Health Organization has recommended the agent of any prion disease should not enter the food chain. Likewise, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States, Health Canada in Canada, and at least 6 state health and natural resource agencies, including Minnesota, recommend people should not consume the meat of an animal found to be positive for chronic wasting disease. Despite these recommendations, the Alliance for Public Wildlife has produced rough estimates suggesting that anywhere from 7,000 to 15,000 chronic wasting disease positive animals are being consumed annually, with that number expected to increase by up to 20% per year. Our public health and public policy experience with bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, or mad cow disease as often known in Europe, primarily the United Kingdom, should be a warning to us today of a potential harbinger of things to come with regard to chronic wasting disease and human infection. BSE was first documented in infected bovine in 1986. British government officials, as well as agriculture industry representatives, stated that the BSE-infected cattle were safe to eat. They claimed the so-called species barrier for prions would prevent transmission from infected cattle to humans as a result of consumption of the contaminated meat. I was asked to serve on 2 different review groups by the British government between 1986 and 1996 when we filed the first human cases. And in each of those deliberations, we came down strongly on the fact that there was a good likelihood that humans, in fact, could become infected. We were considered the bad news pariah at the time. 1996, unfortunately, bore out the truth, as there was, in fact, subsequent transmission. So to claim that there hasn't yet been transmission tells us little, particularly in light of the fact that if you just take the BSE issue or mad cow disease, it was 10 years from when it first showed up until the first human cases showed up. And this is one of the challenges we have today with the rapid escalation of number of cases of BSE in cattle. There have now been more than 200 people with BSE-infected meat exposures in Europe who have been diagnosed with variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and we estimate that there are only 1% of the individuals who were infected that have actually already shown clinical disease, and there is now some evidence that they may actually have late onset of prion-related disease, and so we're not done seeing what might happen in Europe with this issue. Rapid and reliable testing of killed cervids for chronic wasting disease is an absolutely critical part of what we must be doing so that we can make sure that all readily available and utilized tests that a hunter can find are available. Therefore, if these hunters can in fact test their meat, then we can eliminate the exposure of chronic wasting disease prions. This, of course, means that the testing has to be done quickly, very reliably, and in no way hinders the movement of that animal through processing. Although the offered tests often are not considered food safety tests that we have today, results have not detected makes it highly unlikely that with what tests we do have, the prions are not present in the animal if, in fact, it's tested. But as Dean Ames has said, we surely need new and better test methods to facilitate what we're doing. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources conducts chronic waste-induced surveillance around areas with known positives and has done so for at least 3 years. Minnesota currently has a mandatory CWD testing in 3 regions of the state. Mandatory testing was implemented in both the central and north central regions following the discovery of chronic wasting disease positive deer on cervid farms. All the deer harvested in the region on the opening weekend of firearm season are required to be tested. The southeast region started conducting mandatory chronic wasting disease testing after routine surveillance detected 3 positive wild deer in Fillmore County. For this region, testing is conducted on the opening 2 weekends of the firearm season, A and B. Additionally, a chronic wasting disease management zone was created, which circles the epicenter of the initial infections. When a deer is harvested in this zone, it cannot be removed until a test result is received. We must bolster this program substantially. I give the Minnesota DNR great credit. They have been one of the leading DNRs in the country, aggressively and actively pursuing this issue, but there's much more we need to do. Minnesota also offers voluntary CW testing for deer that are harvested outside of a mandatory surveillance region. Hunters who want to test their deer for CWD can pay a fee and submit a sample to the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. Test results are typically reported back 2 to 3 weeks after the sample is registered. We obviously need better testing methods and processes for doing this. Minnesota Department of Health recommendations mirror that of the WHO and CDC as they do not recommend consuming CWD-positive meat. However, if a harvested deer is found to be positive for CWD, the decision what to do with the meat still lies with the hunter. Again, we need much more active and expert assistance in this area. Let me summarize by saying it is my best professional judgment based on my public health experience evaluating BSE transmission to humans in the 1980s and 90s, and my extensive review and evaluation of laboratory research studies attempting to define the extent of the human species barrier for preventing chronic wasting disease transmission, that it is probable that human cases of chronic wasting disease associated with consumption of chronic wasting disease contaminated meat will be documented in the years ahead. It's possible the number of human cases will be substantial and will not be isolated events. For this reason, there must be a major and immediate effort made by public health and natural resource agencies to educate the public, particularly hunters in areas of endemic cervid chronic wasting disease as a potential risk of human CWD infection. And we must provide extensive and reliable and rapid chronic wasting disease prion detection tests for killed cervids before the deer are moved, processed, or consumed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Osterholm. And as I mentioned, we're going to hold the questions till we have a number of presenters, and then we'll take questions from members. Next up is Jerry Torreson. Dr. Torreson. Well, you can all come up if you'd like.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Torreson. I'm the director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and my only function here is to introduce Dr. Sheffers, who is the pathologist at our laboratory who manages all the immunohistochemistry diagnostic testing for chronic wasting disease in our laboratory. Dr. Sheffers.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman Sheffers. Hansen and committee. I'm Dr. Jeremy Sheffers. I'm a pathologist at the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and I've been conducting CWD tests for over a decade. There's a few things that we need to understand. You know, how did we get to this point? What has changed? why the request for a new test. So I'm going to explain what we've done up until this to this point, and I'm going to elaborate on why this isn't working. CWD testing up until this point has been done on dead animals, and the picture you see on the screen is it's actually a cow brain, but if it's a deer brain, it wouldn't matter. The testing is done on a portion of the brain stem called the obex. You don't need to remember that, but just appreciate that it's a very specific part of the brain. We'll take that part of the brain out. We'll put it in formaldehyde for 5 days, and we can't rush that process. It has to sit in formaldehyde for 5 days. Otherwise, it won't stick to the glass slide eventually. So step one is to harvest these tissues that are buried deep into the head. Set them in formaldehyde for 5 days, and then set them through another 25-step process to make a glass slide. So we're dealing with a tissue that is hard to get. The next two slides just basically focus in and down onto the portion of the brain called the obex. Before we had sophisticated immunohistochemistry tests, pathologists would look at brains under the microscope, and they would see the spongy appearance. The brain kind of looked like Swiss cheese. That's clearly not normal. And that's how mad cow disease or bovine spongiform encephalopathy got its name, is because the brain had a spongy appearance just on microscopic exam. Unfortunately, when an animal dies, it decomposes and clear spaces develop, and we couldn't tell the difference between a clear space being mad cow disease or a clear space being decomposition. So additional tests were developed, and the test that we use today is immunohistochemistry. So after about a 35 to 40 step process in 10 to 14 days, depending on how weekends fall, we get a nice little glass slide that I can examine under my microscope. And at that point, all I'm doing is I'm screening the slide for antibodies that flag or tag these misfolded prion protein. And at that point, the infection is fairly far along, and the slides aren't hard to read. There's clear, a lot of them do look like this. There's just a lot of red on a blue background, and everything that's red is misfolded prion. So once I do get the glass slide, report it. A vast majority have been negative. Those that are positive, the Board of Animal Health gets contacted immediately. And the next step would be to identify that herd. And a lot of those herds have been depopulated. So that's the state of testing to this point. So what don't we like about immunohistochemistry? We do everything at cost. And depending on if we get a frozen head that requires thawing and technical expertise to remove those tissues, or if we just get the tissues, the cost can range from $30 to $80. It's slow. It's 4 to 14 days. It's invasive. It can only be done on dead animals. It's laboratory-based. This is not something that can happen at any other lab in the state of Minnesota. If you want immunohistochemistry done for chronic wasting disease on a sample, that the only lab in Minnesota that'll do it is the veterinary diagnostic lab. So it somehow would have to make its way to St. Paul. It's a highly technical procedure. We have dedicated, specialized histo technicians to perform and make these glass slides. But it is accurate. It is the gold standard test, and there are other more rapid tests around, and when they're done, everything usually is confirmed with immunohistochemistry. After doing this for a decade, what have we accomplished? We've depopulated some farms. That's what we've accomplished. Can I say we've slowed the disease down? No. From my perspective, I've just watched it march across North America without really anything getting in its way. So looking forward, I like to solve problems and fix things. And to fix CWD, we need an affordable test, we need a fast test, we need a non-invasive test to be done on live animals and things that live animals leave behind, like feces or urine. It should be field-based. There's a big state. You know, it's not realistic to think that everything is going to end up in St. Paul. It should be simple, user-friendly, and above all, accurate. So in addition to what I mentioned now is the same thing I mentioned in the previous hearing. I had some more notes and a lot of good discussion with a lot of different other people. So I've got just one more paragraph that I want to present. The foundation of patient care sits on an accurate diagnosis. Without an accurate diagnosis, we cannot perform patient care. If we are going to start fighting back against CWD, we need better tests, plural, more than just one. We need to find infected animals before their death, but we don't have a test. We need to know how other animals move CWD prion around the environment, but we don't have a test for that. We need to know if the local butcher shop is contaminated and if it can be effectively cleaned, but we don't have a test for that. We need to know if prions move from the soil into plants and potentially are infective, but we don't have a test for that. We need to know if there is a dose effect of prion. How much is too much? You hear a lot of people say that, well, it's in the soil. I want to know how much is in the soil, and I want to know how much of it takes to infect something. But we don't have a test for that. All hunters need access to a test that can be easily purchased and quickly detect CWD in their deer before it's cut up into 100 pieces and fed to their family. Those hunters don't have access to a test. As this proposal has the potential to answer many of these questions, it is a significant step in the right direction. Thankfully, Dr. Peter and others will describe diagnostic technology that is catching up with CWD, and I think it's time to start fighting back.
Thank you. Dr. Larson and Dr. O.
Chair Hansen and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Peter Larson. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Veterinary and Biomedical Sciences at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm a new faculty member, and I was recently hired as part of the Agricultural Research Education Extension and Technology Transfer Program, the AGREET initiative. I'm a biologist, and I use cutting-edge genomic technologies to investigate challenging biological questions. Chronic wasting disease represents one of the most challenging diseases that we have ever faced. The challenge originates in large part because the pathogenic agent of CWD is a nearly indestructible prion protein that is spread through bodily fluids and that can persist in the environment for years. The CDC recommends that we not consume CWD-positive venison, and there is growing public health concern. It is abundantly clear that we must act now to confront the CWD threat in Minnesota. In order to confront chronic wasting disease, we must be innovative, and we must leverage our individual strengths. Earlier this week, I traveled to Preston, ground zero for the ongoing CWD outbreak in southeastern Minnesota. I spent Tuesday at the DNR field office. I wanted to meet those in the front lines of the CWD battlefield to learn what the DNR is dealing with on the ground, to help them collect tissues as part of their surveillance effort, and to talk with them about the things that we can do together to confront this emerging disease. It was an incredible experience, and I have a greater understanding of and respect for the challenges that the DNR and others are facing when managing CWD. If we are to be successful in confronting this emerging pathogen, we must leverage the collective strengths of the DNR, the Board of Animal Health, and of researchers at the University of Minnesota. We must work together to identify novel and innovative solutions. One area that we, scientists at the University of Minnesota, have research strengths in is the development of novel diagnostics. As we heard earlier from Dr. Sheffers, the current state of CWD diagnostics is grim. Confirmatory tests can take days or weeks to conduct. Hunters who want to test their deer for CWD must endure a significant wait time to receive a result. Those who manage farm deer populations do not have access to a rapid live animal test. Those who monitor CWD in the wild do not have a rapid and sensitive test capable of providing real-time information from harvested deer or from the environment. We are currently unable to identify and manage the disposal of CWD-positive carcasses in our state, and it is not currently feasible to screen for CWD prions within facilities that process venison for human consumption. A rapid and accurate real-time diagnostic test for CWD must be developed and deployed to those who are battling this emerging disease. We are proposing to develop an innovative and new chronic wasting disease detection method that will be faster and cheaper than current assays. We're talking about results within minutes or hours, not days or weeks. We've described this technology in invention disclosure form, and that is with the University of Minnesota Office of Technology and Commercialization. The technology we will use to develop this new diagnostic tool simply was not available in the recent past. However, this technology is available now, and we must take advantage of this unique opportunity. The test that we will develop will help reduce the spread of CWD and will help prevent contaminated venison from entering our food supply. We have assembled a remarkable team of scientists to develop this test. Our team includes Professor Pam Skinner, an expert on prion diseases, who is working on prion cure strategies and has developed prion disease biomarker assays. Dr. Jeremy Sheffers, who's an expert on current chronic wasting disease diagnostics at the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. Dr. Davis Seelig, who is an expert on CWD prion biology and existing CWD diagnostics. And Dr. Sang-Yan Oh, who is an expert in nanotechnology and microfluidics and will speak shortly. Myself, I am an expert in animal biology and emerging genomic technologies. We have also secured the collaborative support of two world leaders in the CWD research field, Dr. Ed Hoover of Colorado State University and Dr. Claudio Soto of the University of Texas. Together, we are prepared to leverage our collective strengths to design a rapid and accurate chronic wasting disease diagnostic test that will ultimately provide a real-time view of the CWD landscape in Minnesota and beyond. We will work with the DNR and the Board of Animal Health throughout the process of developing this test. The goal is to provide those in the front lines with a cutting-edge tool that will help them monitor and manage CWD. This tool will also help us to limit or prevent CWD prions from entering our food supply. Let me be clear. This is not a silver bullet for CWD. Instead, the development of this rapid diagnostic test is a necessary and critical first step that is required to confront this emerging pathogen. Thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Oh.
Thank you. Dr. Oh.
Chairman Hansen and representatives, thank you for your time to meet with us today. My name is Sang-Yan Oh. I am a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Minnesota. I joined the U in 2006, and for the last 13 years, I have directed a research program on nanotechnology, manufacturing, and biomedical sensors. For this CWD project, I will focus on developing new biosensors that can rapidly detect a small number of protein molecules. My team will engineer an initial prototype device to prove our concept. Rapid prion detection is an extremely challenging engineering problem and cannot be solved by engineers or biologists alone. Fortunately, we have a great multidisciplinary team to tackle the problem. I will combine two elements, namely nanotechnology and microfluidics. Nanotechnology is what enables the computer industry to make extremely small transistors in computer chips. This miniaturization process improves the speed and computing power while reducing the cost of chips. The same principle of miniaturization can also benefit biomedical sensors. As we miniaturize sensors and sample tubes in a scheme called microfluidics, we can use them to detect biomarkers much faster and with greater sensitivity. Both nanotechnology and microfluidics are critical for CWD detection, and they will allow for the production of cheaper, faster diagnostic tests for broader usage. We make such small devices in a dedicated clean room environment at the U called the Minnesota Nano Center. When my colleagues develop improved molecular biology recipes for prion detection, I will translate the recipe and perform the test in a tiny microfluidic chamber, which will allow us to detect a small number of protein molecules with very high sensitivity and improved speed. At the U, my group has invented a number of patented technologies for concentrating and sensing tiny amounts of protein molecules, which will be leveraged in this project. The results from my lab has been published in over 100 journal papers, and several former students from my group are working at Minnesota companies such as 3M and Seagate technology. I think that our sensors and manufacturing technologies will find broader applications, including Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, as well as potential commercialization opportunities. I am committed to take my research one step further and demonstrate technology that can have a real impact for people in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. And Dr. Larson, I think you've provided a list of publications as well, recent scientific publications.
That's correct. Chair Hansen and members of the committee, I did a literature search, pulled together some recent peer-reviewed publications and provided links to those publications, and you have that before you in a handout, I believe.
So we have a list for questions. First is Representative Claflin.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I was very startled by some of the descriptions of the disease that's emerging in Europe, the late onset of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, especially, is concerning. And we know that this transferred to people from cattle because the beef entered our food supply. How concerned should we be about consumption of venison and cross-contamination to other meat in a butcher shop? Should I avoid feeding my family wild venison?
Chair Hansen and members of the committee, I'll provide an answer to that, but we might also want to invite Dr. Osterholm up to elaborate. Right now, what I can say is that the CDC recommends that we do not eat contaminated venison. The reality is that it's difficult. We don't have an accurate test to confirm presence or absence of CWD prions in meat. There's growing concern, as Dr. Holstrom alluded to in his testimony, that CWD prions could infect humans, but there is no documented cases. So there's no publications showing that. What there is, and this is a publication on the list that I assembled, a recent publication that was published out of the CDC Emerging Infectious Diseases Journal, I believe this last September, showed that CWD prions, specific strains of CWD prions, can convert human prion proteins in cell culture. So that's an important observation, that it's in basically a petri dish. There's also reports of a study from Canada where they fed CWD-contaminated meat to monkeys or macaques, and those monkeys developed a neurodegenerative disease. And that paper is not published yet. That study has not been published yet. So when we say that there's growing concern, that's why there's growing concern, is because there are some preliminary indications that there is some level of risk.
If maybe Dr. Osterholm could answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Osterholm.
Representative. First of all, again, I come back to the word perspective. The issue is that if you think about the BSE, mad cow disease problem in England, for which there were many thousands of animals that made its way into the food system, we have 200 cases of BSE in humans with all the meat that was consumed. Now, those are tragedies. It caused a great deal of disheaval to the entire meat industry of Europe, and surely challenged a number of areas of confidence in government and the whole area of agriculture. So it doesn't take a lot to cause a big problem. But the question you're asking is the billion-dollar question. Is it safe for my child to eat venison from a deer? Again, I come back to a comment I made earlier, and that is the fact that we are fortunate that the Minnesota DNR have been very aggressive in this area, and I think to the extent that we have had control of it, to the extent we have, is because of their aggressive work to do so, and I would urge this legislative body or all the bodies to continue to support that work very much. So the first thing you want to do is keep it to the limited number of animals that are infected, so no matter what venison you eat, it's not going to ever be a problem. The second area, though, is where they have defined the problem, meaning the area. So if you're in far southwestern Minnesota right now, we don't have any evidence that there's a problem in that area. But if you happen to be near Preston, Minnesota, that's a very different situation. When you now know that, you can be more informed because you better have your deer tested if you're consuming it from an area like Preston as opposed to, say, southwestern Minnesota. So the more in surveillance data, the more information we have will help. Should you eat an infected deer venison part, what is the risk? Again, you've already heard we don't have evidence of human cases, but the problem with that is that there's this delayed onset, and we won't know until weeks after the accident's already happened in the intersection that there was a tragic accident there. And so that's our problem. So to tell you in short, if you're eating a deer from a area with CWD activity, get it tested. Don't do it. Second of all, make sure that the deer you are eating also has not gone through a processing center, a meatpacking environment, where CWD deer were also co-mingled in that environment because of the stability of this prion. And otherwise, if you're in the rest of Minnesota, I wish you well and hope you enjoy your venison.
And follow-up, Chair?
Representative Claflin.
In the absence of this available test, how worried should women who are pregnant or may become pregnant be about consuming venison? Is this something that can transfer across the placenta or transfer at birth?
Dr. Ostrom or Dr.
Well, have, first of all, again, there are many unknowns, even still with the BSE issue from England. One of the areas we were most concerned about in England was, in fact, blood transfusions. And we actually had evidence of cases in humans contracted from having had a blood transfusion somebody who was infected. Today, we use a process in our blood processing environment that actually greatly eliminates that. So even if you do have CWD, it's not likely to be transmitted on. In terms of the issue with to an unborn child, we just have no data on that whatsoever. I'm not aware of any experience, whether it be with BSE or another prion disease called Kuru, et cetera, where we've had evidence that somebody who is infected with a prion-related disease then had a unique transmission issue to the unborn child.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, when I said that the development of this test was not a silver bullet, that's really an important observation because we need to conduct research in lots of areas with respect to chronic wasting disease to help answer the question that you just asked. And so part of what we're talking about here is the launch of a really intensive research effort to answer questions like that. And it could be that people have looked at that maybe in a mouse model. But the reality is that we need to be looking at primates, and we need to be using emerging cutting-edge technologies to help answer those questions.
Thank you.
Representative Claflin. I do want to note before the next question, we have guests here, 11th and 12th grade students from Groves Academy in St. Louis Park. Welcome. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've mentioned a couple times, and I know I've thought of this as far as meat processing. And so, you know, I think of my cousin doing it in his garage, or, you know, the place we use in Bemidji, the locker plant in Bemidji that we use, that my family's used. And wondering about how easily it spreads, and if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think most of us, when we think of disease transmission when it comes to food and meat, you know, I kind of think of like when you cook chicken and you got your Clorox wipes out and you wash your hands and you do all those things. Could you talk a little bit about how the prions are different, and if you could just go talk a little bit about that.
Go ahead. Chair Hansen, members of the committee. First off, I'm not a prion biologist, and Dr. David Selig and Dr. Pam Skinner, they are prion biologists, and they were unable to make it today. But what I can say, based on the literature that I've read, is that these prions are concerning because they can persist in the environment for a long time. They're almost indestructible. And part of what we're talking about, the need to develop this test, and Dr. Schaefer's alluded to this, is what we'll be able to do with this test is basically go into a processing facility like that and swab down the saws or the cutting tools or the surfaces and enrich the prions from those swabs and understand about the level of prion contamination that's there. And when we're able to do that in conjunction with our collaborators at Colorado State and the University of Houston in Texas, we'll be able to understand what that minimum dose, if you will, is. And we'll be able to talk about over time what that prion landscape is like, and if it's at a level that's very high, that's concerning, or maybe there's a minimum threshold that is tolerable and not as of much concern. But the bottom line is we don't have the technology to do that. And we're saying that we want to develop that technology to help answer some of those questions.
Dr.
Chair, Madam Representative. If Stephen King could write an infectious disease novel, he'd write about prions. These are chemical substances that are stable yet at 1,600 degrees, so you can't cook them away. They're very difficult to destroy from a chemical perspective. I have been involved in cases where individuals were accidentally operated on who had Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a prion-related disease, and in the process of then realizing upon doing the surgery that they really had Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, much of that surgical equipment had to be landfilled. It could not be disinfected. They couldn't use it again. So the point being is that if you put this into a meat processing plant, of which, because I've worked up so many infectious disease issues around bacterial pathogens of this, this is a kind of a worst-case nightmare. Now, as you just heard, the question is how much contamination occurs, what occurs with it, what's the level, and so forth. But this is an area of grave concern. And I think that one of the areas, again, that the DNR has emphasized has been not just the idea of the venison for the individual hunter, but where does that carcass go and how is it processed? And I, again, would urge this all to support their ongoing efforts at education. There is a debate right now in the meat processing world where some firms have literally stopped processing deer because they don't believe they can do it safely. Others say we can do it safely and continue to do it. Now, I don't know how to do it safely myself, but so I would say this is a challenge for us. Now, will the transmission result from that? We don't know. But I think, again, we're playing with fire.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know in a previous discussion there was one story that was shared about a rock being able to be a vector. Could you share that
right,
with the public?
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen and members of the committee, Representative Beckerfin. Yes, there. Our collaborator, Dr. Soto, has been involved in very sophisticated research experiments where they have taken environmental samples, a rock, if you will, that were within a CWD contaminated area, and then put that sample into a cage of a hamster model that they were working with, and over time that hamster developed chronic wasting disease. So there, and this again, this is on the literature list that I shared with you. There are studies showing that CWD prions can persist in the environment. They can basically adhere to different soil types. They can adhere to the roots of plants and be uptaken into those plants and expressed in the leaves of those plants. So this gets at the heart of as to why this is such a complex and difficult to manage issue, because it requires expertise across multiple fields, ecology, soil types. So yes, there's evidence showing that prions in the environment are at a level of sufficient to at least infect a hamster. But again, what we're talking about here is developing the tests to get at that a better quantification to understand how that really infects deer and large-bodied
animals.
Representative
Mr.
Finn.
Chair, could I just,
Dr. Ostrom.
Chair, Representative. First of all, I want to support the comments here. They were very appropriate. I just would like to leave you with an experience that continues to haunt me and has haunted me for a long time. From 1986 to 1996, I was one of those people, again, that kept talking about this, and time and time and time and time again, people came back and said, oh, you just scare the hell out of us all the time. You know, you're just, that's what you do, okay? And then 1996 changed it all. And when we watched those cases pour in initially of Bering Kreuzfeldt Jakob, there was no satisfaction of what we went through the last 10 years. You are going to hear from people that this is not going to be a problem other than a game farm issue. You're going to hear from people that it's not going to transmit to people. And I hope they're right, but I wouldn't bet on it. And if we lose this one and haven't done all we can do and what we just heard, we will pay a price. I worry desperately that the white-tailed deer industry in this country, the hunting industry, will tank. And why do I worry about that? Well, of course, it's not just because of hunters, but one of the control measures we have today to minimize the problem is to actually do good herd management, which means hunting is a very critical part of that. So I could see a whole cascade of events. So I think as this committee considers all these issues, just remember what happened in England and all the naysayers who said it was not going to be a problem, there was nothing to worry about, and look where we had to go through.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of last follow-up. So I know, you know, for me, venison has been the protein base of my diet my entire life, and it has been for my children thus far in their lives. And so I think there really is the urgency to comprehensively do something sooner than later. I definitely think, like, we have to do the test. We have to invest in this and develop it. But I think, you know, I keep hearing all these different vectors of the way that it could, you know, all these things we don't have answers to. Just wondering if the test, you know, even if I could magically give you the money today to start working on this, it's still a couple years out. As far as containing the spread of the disease in the meantime, do you have recommendations on things that can be done in the meantime while we're waiting for the test? Because it really seems like we need to comprehensively address this.
Chair Hansen.
Dr. Larson.
Members of the committee. I'll be the first to say that I think the experts to help answer that question are going to be with the DNR and the Board of Animal Health. I think that from what I saw in my visit to Preston and working with the DNR on Tuesday, they're doing an amazing job, and they are in touch with the methods that are recommended for managing this disease. And so I think that to answer that question, talking with the DNR and the Board of Animal Health is the best way to do that. But from my observation, I'm very impressed, and I think that we're doing an excellent job right now in the field.
Mr. Chair.
Dr. Ostrom.
Representative. Let me just add a couple of perspectives. Right now, as I mentioned, the prion is limited in its geographic distribution in Minnesota. We can't let cervid farming continue to spread that and let the responsibility fall where it may. And that has been the responsible party that has brought us the problem and has spread it widely in North America and Canada. What's happened. What doesn't have to be tomorrow. So let's keep it limited to the locations it is right now. Second thing, as a friendly amendment I would offer, I think the Minnesota Department of Health also has to be very involved, as do the federal partners. We're having discussions right now with the CDC and the NIH and others about how they have to elevate the critical nature of this situation and make it clear that this is a very critical, time-sensitive public health issue. We must do much more in the way of education. I think we've only done a limited amount of that as a public health community across the country, in fact, across North America. People have to understand the significance of this, and we can't wait until we have the first cases coming. And then, of course, everybody will overreact at that point. When I say overreact, you know, we'll do draconian things at that point. We need to do the public health-based sound practices right now, and that's educating about testing, how you can actually consume safe venison by knowing that your animal is not infected with a prion. That's what we need to get done. That's where the testing program can play a key role. If testing is a limiting feature because it's not available, it takes too long, it's too expensive, it's not going to get done. And that's what we need to make sure that we have those tools so that that's not a reason why.
Thank you.
If I could just follow up to that real quickly.
Dr. Lars.
One issue that has come out in our discussions with respect to farm cervids is that they're going to have insight as to how this pathogen spreads within a contained environment that in the wild we will never be able to understand, because in a wild system it's so biologically and ecologically complex that it would take decades to understand transmission routes and whatnot. And so there's a bit of a something that gets lost in this discussion, I think, with respect to the farm cervids, and that is that there is a incredibly unique opportunity to go and look at those situations with the tools that we're talking about to develop. That's going to give us an edge. That's going to give us something that I think others maybe in Colorado or Wisconsin haven't looked at it the same way. And so from a research perspective, we need to understand the importance of that.
Thank you. And as a follow-up to that, would we need to contain those facilities after depopulation, considering your testimony about inanimate objects, if we have to secure the, I'm using we here broadly, but just if you have to prevent cross-contamination by other animals coming into there?
Chair Hansen, yes, that's an excellent point. CWD is spread through the environment by small mammals, by rodents. Birds could potentially serve as a vector. So yes, and one issue that it sounds strange, but from a modeling perspective, if you were to try to model this pathogen in the environment, the only thing that I can think of that it would be similar to is modeling radioactive material because of the connections with soil, because of how animals spread it through the environment. And so, yes, those contained areas that have CWD positive, that they're confirmed, that is an issue. We need to look at something, at ways to mitigate that risk. And what we're talking about here is a broader initiative.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on some of the questions that Representative Baker Finn was asking. We know that this is the study that you're advocating for is a two-year type, at least a couple of years before it is done, before you have this test. And you had said that this is the first step, and I'm not quite understanding the role of the College of Veterinary Medicine here. You have no role except research. There's no public health role, or because I listened to Dr. Osterholm, and I see that, I mean, your quote, there must be major and immediate effort made by public health and natural resource agencies to educate the public, et cetera. Who all is responsible for this? So does the College of Veterinary Medicine just wash their hands of this? I don't understand.
Dean Ames.
Hi, Representative Wagenius, Chair Hansen. So the College of Veterinary Medicine has a very, very long track record of promoting public health. The focus of veterinary public health tends to be in those diseases that are transmitted from animals to humans. And so that can be, like we've been talking about just now, what we would call foodborne disease, but it can also be diseases like I've talked to you about in the past, like high path avian influenza and other contagious diseases that we've eliminated from livestock populations in the United States, like brucellosis and tuberculosis, through the work of researchers at veterinary colleges and government agencies. So the role of the veterinary college is to provide the information and the tools and train professionals so that they are prepared to work in the field with those tools and help with control efforts.
Representative Wiggins.
Okay, so let's assume that we are going to go ahead with the rapid response. What is your role in these years between right this minute and to get to the rapid response? What's your role right now, given the testimony that we've had about the interaction with human health and with other wildlife? So what is your role right now?
Dean Ames.
Representative Wagenius, Chair Hansen. So the role of the veterinary college right now is to educate and train professionals and train advanced professionals so that they can aid in the public health educational process that Dr. Osterholm talked about. We don't have active research programs right now outside of Dr. Skinner, who was here a couple of weeks ago and is working on various therapies for prion-based disease and some vaccine strategies for prion-based disease. These are very, very hard diseases to work with. And so that is kind of the focus of what goes on. So I'll just give you a perspective of the training programs that we're involved with training veterinary public health professionals. In the United States, there are a number of schools that train combined doctor of veterinary medicine and master of public health. We train 160. Well, that's how many we have enrolled in our program. That's more than the rest of the country put together. So we're very, very active in training these professionals to go out and help with implementing policy and putting policy into place. Many of the people that are on the staff, the veterinarians that work in the Board of Animal Health, are DVM MPHs that have come out of our program. There's a number that work in the Minnesota Department of Health. Dr. Osterholm was noted for the number of veterinarians he hired to work in the Department of Health when he was there. So there's a lot of professionals that are being trained and are disseminating public health information and helping to implement policies. And we even have some working in the DNR.
If I could follow up quickly.
Dr. Larson and then Osterholm and then back to Representative Wagenius. So
just to add. So I'm a recent hire. I was hired under the AgREIT initiative. Part of the mission that I'm tasked with is to help with emerging problems like this. And so there's a cohort of faculty, new faculty, to help confront issues like this chronic wasting disease issue. It's part of the reason why I'm here today, part of the reason why I was with the DNR on Tuesday, is to get a better understanding of what's going on out there and what are some innovative new strategies that we can use. And so part of my research program at the U is to help tackle these difficult questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you've asked, again, another billion-dollar question. I see us in a very important stage of transition. The early conversations around chronic wasting disease were largely about herd management issues that have always been common in the white-tailed deer population issues. You know, how do we get what kind of population we want for what kind of things in the hunters? We have some experts in the room who know that. In that population, the debate was often not about a public health problem, but about what do we do to, in fact, deal with this? Do we actually go in and kill lots of deer? Do we continue to try to maintain it? I think we need to fundamentally change that discussion substantially. It needs to become a public health issue. I'm tired of hearing somebody get up and stand and say, I've eaten 23 deer that were chronic waste and disease positive, and look at me. Okay? You know, that is crazy, and we shouldn't take that as expert advice. What we need is a comprehensive public health veterinary medicine, human medicine, the DNR. All of us need to come together and have a conversation with the deer hunters of Minnesota and those who consume the venison that this is a very critical public health problem, but there's a lot we can do about it, and we can do it in a very constructive and safe way. And I think that means we have to get involved in the conversation, too. You can't have some wildlife manager from the DNR expected to be the point person for all these issues. They can surely deal with herd management, but we have to help under the population. So I think you're right on the mark. I would say that the College of Veterinary Medicine has been a major player in public health issues, what we call One Health, animal issues, and we need to be present out there as public health together to deal with that issue.
And just before I go back to Representative Wagenius and then to Dr. Ames, I do want to note that what we asked for today was to have a comprehensive group of people here. The difference between Representative Purcell's committee presentation and here was to pull together where you have human health, you have the veterinary side, and the environmental side. And I know it's been harder to get the soils and the plant folks with the weather and timing and everything. So in addition, for the world here, I've talked with Chair Liebling and Chair Schultz and Chair Poppy, because this is really a triangle here of where we're all part of this. And so internally here, we've got that going as well. So Representative Guineas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You did a lot to answer my question, but it feels to me like, I mean, we do not have a strong team. If this is going to be part of the responsibility of our Department of Health, they need more resources. There's no question in my mind about it. There are many things that they should be doing that they're not doing because they don't have the resource. We won't get into that now, but we will later. So there's that DNR. Where does the money come from? And that's why I was trying to get at where the College of Veterinary Medicine comes in not just educating the professionals, but educating the public. Because this is a public health issue. So, that's a given. So, if it's an all hands on deck, and I think it is, then it is not enough for you to tell me you're going to educate the professionals. Mm-hmm. It seems to me you've got to be educating the public about this public health issue.
Chair Hansen.
Dr. Larson.
You're exactly right. And on my way back from my visit with the DNR, I reached out to the Bell Museum of Natural History. I said I want to organize a public outreach event for the public. And so this is something that I'm trying to do at my level. My level as scientist, individual researcher is to start doing what I can do to organize these events and to reach as many people as possible. I talked to the DNR about their public outreach that's going on, and you're absolutely right. We need to take more steps to that, and I'm doing what I can, doing what I can, and that's something that I'm going to organize within the next few months. And so, you will start seeing more public outreach by our faculty group on this issue.
Dean Ames and.
Yeah, I
just want to know what I've got four people on the list.
Representative Hansen, committee members, I just wanted to kind of follow up with in response to Representative Wagenius with another example that I think is useful. And of course, you know, point is very well made and taken that we have veterinarians with extension appointments that are involved in educational programs and training the trainers and disseminating information on a variety of areas. And so certainly take that as part of our mission. But a very, very important disease that we all just take for granted and assume that we never have to worry about that disease and that we can even consider drinking unpasteurized milk is bovine brucellosis. And that was the disease that commonly infected cattle. They shed it into their milk, and it was a very common thing for human beings to contract that disease and experience a disease syndrome that humans called undulant fever. And so that disease, we knew quite a bit about the behavior of the disease. It was certainly easier to work with was because it was a bacteria and not this very resistant, hard to work with prion. But we spent a lot of time and effort at the University of Minnesota and developed a blood test that allowed us to identify positive cattle. And it was that test that then allowed us to move forward in the control programs and eventually eliminate that disease so that basically every milk cow in the United States, every beef cow in the United States is certified free of bovine brucellosis. Very few countries outside of the developed countries in the world can say that. And so that's an example of how it's very important to have the research tools that can drive the tests, that can drive the control programs that can then be, go hand in hand with the public education.
Representative Wiggins.
I get that. I am a huge proponent of science. Anybody around here will tell you that. I am trying to pin down what's going to happen between the times you have the science completed and today. Today is the day. We've got to start with the public health issue.
Dr. Ostrom, and then I'll go to the next question.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Again, you raise a very, very important point. This is much more than just some research. This is research tied to really public outreach. And let me just say, at the risk of getting a little off field, I think many of us were saddened this past week with the passing of Senator Benson. One of the proudest moments of my life was when Senator Moe and Senator Benson in 1985 made it mandatory for every senator, all Senate staff, to spend a five-hour period locked up with me in a room to understand about HIV/AIDS. And we had one of the most informed legislative bodies in the world in terms of considering HIV-related legislation and, more importantly, leadership in the community. And I think that what you're doing here, frankly, is really important. I've already had three texts from media who are watching this live who I think are drawing attention to this very issue that might not have been. And I think legislators have to be educated on this in a big way because whether it's white-tailed deer management or what's happening in the local agriculture side or what's happening with meat processing, it's all about elected leadership. And so I congratulate you for helping to elevate this issue and for you all to be part of this discussion too. At those local meetings, we need to have you there too. And it's very important that that part of it. So I think we accept at the university, it's not just, okay, we'll be here without saying how. I mean, we're here today. I promise you we're not going to give up on this issue. And we welcome the partnership with the legislators here too to also help inform Minnesota citizens about what's happening.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it was Dr. Larson that earlier stated that your current immunohistochemistry is the gold standard. Is that accurate? Just give me a yes or no. I got a follow up.
Dr. Sheffers is who is working on.
Okay, I thought it was Mr. Larson, but if you can answer the question, I got a follow up.
Yes, that's correct. And, IHC is
and that and that's it, that gold is worth 95%, 98% statistically. Do you have a number?
Sure, 98%.
Dr. Larson.
98? You'd go with 98?
It's an important test.
Okay. And then my follow-up then is, Mr. Chair, so you know something about the chemistry, obviously, of these prions, and is that the future, the chemistry?
Chair Hansen and Representative Purcell, yes, it's critically important to understand prion biology, how that those prions, that chemistry that you're alluding to, how that works to develop the next generation of tools that we're talking about here.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and that
7%.
I'm specifically going to a rapid test. You know something about the chemistry, and you can use that to develop your rapid test, and that's reasonably the direction you're going.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Larson. Thank you. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one who, prior to 1996, visited England fairly frequently and consumed a fair amount of their beef, even though it did not match the quality that we enjoy here on the North American continent. I also still raise a few beef cattle. I watched and participated in a variety of ways with the issue we had with BSE and continue that it's not something we can just sweep into the background. And I guess what I kind of see missing here, those folks with the DMV next to their name, hats off, because the reason they're there is to protect public health. That's what they do. My real question is, though, where are the USDA people? Where are the meat processing people? Because we went through unbelievable, excruciating efforts to make sure that we protected public safety from issue of BSE, and that may, Mr. Chair, be something that we need to take a look at. And the other one is we've got some very strict world protocols for domestic livestock that would have a variety of diseases, and BSE being one of them. They slammed the borders shut across the world over that, and we'll still do it if it gets out of hand. So the second part of it is, what are we doing, and this may be another group of people you need to bring in here, what are we doing on a little more global scale? The World Health Organization can tick off everything you better do and what you better not do relative to BSE and a whole variety of things. So have we got something like that, at least on the North American continent? A protocol that says, here's the real deal, here's what we know, and here's what we can and can't do.
Dr. Sheffers, or Dean Ames?
Chair Hansen.
Dr. Sheffers.
If I understand the question, you're asking, what is the BSE program, or what does that look like?
No, I understand intimately what the program is for BSE. What I'm talking about is we got a similar situation with prion-driven disease. We've got a huge amount of protocol in place at literally everywhere we deal with beef, at the packing level, at the borders, internationally, at the World Health level. Do we at least have what we know and the procedures in place on the North American continent for chronic wasting disease? I don't believe we have anything at the international level, but there's a huge set of things that you can't do if you deal with beef, for example, and provide it to the public that are directly related to making sure we don't end up with BSE getting into people's diet.
Right. So,
Dr. Sheffers.
Chair Hansen, committee members, there isn't, you know, to answer your question, there isn't really anything in place for chronic wasting disease. The USDA did oversee chronic wasting disease testing. Their funding dried up, funding priorities changed, and then they pushed that CWD testing responsibility on to the state level. Our Board of Animal Health deemed it important and kept it in place. Other states did not. When compared to mad cow disease, any cow that I get into the D-Lab that is over 2 years old, that has anything potentially wrong with its brain, has to be tested for BSE. That doesn't apply for deer. So I think briefly to answer your question, no, there's really nothing in place for CWD.
Again, Mr. Chair, and that's the point. I could have told you that. Simply because I'm part of that industry and have lived with that issue with BSE and the potential health threat there. And we've got a lot of procedures, as you just articulated. And so that's a whole area where we need to really focus on. And that starts from the World Health Center all the way down to a local meatpacking plant. So Again, maybe subject of a completely different presentation, because we've been there before on this type of threat, and we've been able to at least, as best we can, manage it and protect the public health.
And Representative Lewick, I know that there are congressional staff in the audience, and there have been several bipartisan pieces of legislation have gone in, some on assessment, some on research, some on reimbursement for the Fish and Wildlife agencies. And I think that, again, Minnesota can be a leader here, but there's a we're part of a bigger picture. I know my colleagues and our colleagues in other states that I've talked to are very concerned and often are looking to Minnesota on things like this. And so I think this is the first of probably several discussions on this, but we wanted to get the science here, and I think as with most science, it leads to more questions. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I got reached out to Congressman Colin Peterson, too, earlier today, and want to have a conversation with him about what's going on in his Ag Committee. Gentlemen, thank you for being here, and I appreciated the update that we got a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things that I'm looking at is the chronic wasting disease, the peer-reviewed publication sheet that's before us. The third bullet point that talks about soil humic acids degrade CWD prion, and help me understand those. Because for me, if these prions are going to be in the environment, it would seem to me we have to figure out a way to get rid of them. And I don't know if that's possible. Maybe science will lead us there someday. But I feel like, you know, the dog is chasing his tail here if we don't do actually try to do something about the prions themselves that exist out there. So walk me through who and what is being done with regards to treatment of the prions in the environment, if that's even possible.
Dr. Larson.
Chair Hansen, committee members. Yes, so CWD prions can bind to different soil types. There's a body of literature that discusses that, and that paper on there will talk about that. The information in that paper will tell us, will provide clues for how we can mitigate this in the environment. The bottom line is, though, if you go down around Preston and go out and look at that landscape, that's incredibly complex. What we're doing in the Veterinary Medicine College is, so I'm organizing a CWD super group of researchers of about 15 faculty members, and we're going to reach out to people in ecology and people with experience in soils and talk with them about this. This is such a important and rapidly evolving situation that we need to bring groups like that together to help answer the questions that you're asking. So yes, I think that we do have expertise at the university to help look at how this can be decontaminated in the natural setting. But the bottom line is, nature is incredibly complex, and the idea of trying to remove prions and soil from a deer that goes on a 70-mile sojourn, that's difficult. And so, The key will be to how can we mitigate those prions within the farmed deer populations in those areas.
Thank you.
Representative Sandell, and then Representative Morrison, and then I think we're about it for the day. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. In the sake of time, I'll pass.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, doctors, for your very sobering presentation. I'm curious if you can share with us how confident your team is that you can develop the desired test with adequate funding.
So, Chair Hansen, members of the committee, I'll be the first to say that I'm very, very confident. I'm very excited. One of the reasons why is that the team that we have assembled it covers this entire spectrum from the basic biology to the develop and manufacturing of the tests. And after I've seen what Dr. O and his lab has produced, I know that this is feasible, and I know that these are questions that Dr. O and his team They have the expertise to be able to help design the prototype. The key issue is that he's got to work closely with the biologists, with us, with those that understand the biology of prions, and working together, that's the way that we're going to pull this off, and it can only be done in an environment like the University of Minnesota.
Chairman Hansen and committee members. So in my laboratory, so I have experienced a similar effort working with biologists and medical researchers to build working groups. So once the biological protocols are ready, I will be the engineer who implement it into a chip, eventually a portable chip. So I have students and postdoctoral researchers already working in my laboratories. They are, once the project starts, they are ready to get in action right away. So we also have all the equipment necessary. So we will try our best to get things done as quickly as possible.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the other part of this is that testing in itself is a very critical tool. But then how it's applied and understood, and I think the previous questions also apply to this, finding a prion in the environment may or may not mean anything significant from a biologic standpoint. And what we need to do is understand the epidemiology. Where is the risk factors? How do these animals become infected? Is it really saliva-to-saliva contact, or is what's in the environment important? And I agree with Dr. Larson's previous comment that in the wildlife area, that's going to be harder to find. In some of the game farm situations, we may actually have a greater chance of actually understanding it. We know for many biologic agents that are potential disease causers, just because they're in the environment doesn't mean you get sick or infected from those. It's a certain experience, how you do it, what's the level you get exposed to. So this team at the university actually expands beyond just the basic R&D to the applied research and the understanding, and that's what we really want to know. What really makes a difference? And I think that's what you'll get with this opportunity here.
Thank you. That's very exciting and reassuring.
Thank you. And that was our intent in trying to get a comprehensive approach to this. I think there's, as Representative Fabian noted, you have the soils research, our environmental sciences, looking at resilience of prions, each of those things. So I want to thank you for your preparation for today, and we look forward to continued conversation. I also want to note, as Dr. Larson did, the people have been working out in the field on the front lines. And I know there, when I brought my deer in, there was the veterinary students who collected the sample, those folks that are there trying to help out. We appreciate their support. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to point out, too, for the members, if you haven't read the MOU that's been signed by the DNR and the Board of Animal Health with regards to CWD, I'd encourage you to take a look at that. And I applaud both agencies for being willing to roll up their sleeves and get it done. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have an item of business we need to do before the end of the day here, before the end of the committee meeting. Next up, we have House File 80, First Division Engrossment. This bill was heard and laid over on Tuesday, February 5th. The committee intends to limit itself to taking procedural action to re-refer the bill to Ways and Means. Representative Claffin, would you like to move House File 80?
I move that House File 80, First Division Engrossment, be re-referred to Ways and Means, and I request a roll call.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's going to Ways and Means. Can you tell me what the majority's plan is for getting this to the floor? I feel like this has been kind of a ping-pong ball that's bounced around somewhat needlessly, and I'm anxious to get this done. MPCA has testified this is their number one priority. And so I'd just like to know what the majority's plan is for bringing this to the House floor and getting something done.
Representative Fabian, it's going to be in Ways and Means on Monday. So that's what I know from this point on. So I think there are several bills that are calendared for Ways and Means, and obviously they to do the fiscal work on it and go from there. So I have not had any information on when it would hit the floor, but I know that there's a strong desire for us to get it out of here and into Ways and Means on Monday.
Well, I support that. I just wish it would have happened like 2 weeks ago. Thank you.
So, any further discussion? Clerk would take the roll.
This is a roll call vote to re-refer House File 80 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Hansen.
Yes.
Claflin.
Yes.
Fabian.
Yes.
Backer.
Yes.
Becker Finn.
Yes.
Eklund.
Yes.
Fisher.
Yes.
Green.
Yep.
Heintzman.
Yes.
Lee.
Yes.
Lewick.
Yes.
Morrison.
Yes.
New.
Yes.
Purcell.
Aye.
Sandell.
Yes.
Sundin.
Yes.
Wagenius.
Yes.
Vote is 10-0. The motion passes, and it is referred to... referred to Ways and Means. Yeah. More than 10. 17-0. 17.
Some say she's more stubborn than me.
You can't read your own writing. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.